Jeremy Greenhouse is joining us. He's a partner with the Environmental Law Group in Minneapolis. He advises clients on a broad range of environmental laws with a focus on surface water and groundwater regulations and permitting. He regularly speaks and writes on environmental issues. Welcome, Jeremy.
Well, thank you very much. As Ellen said, I'm an attorney at the Environmental Law Group. We are a boutique law firm. We have six attorneys and practice solely in the area of environmental law. It's our sole focus and our passion as well. We have a broad range of over 20 years experience average per attorney in a broad range of environmental laws, including water law, which is kind of my area of focus. I should mention, speaking to this group, that we work regularly with environmental scientists and have a huge respect for what all of you do. Our practice would not exist without the ability to collaborate with scientists. I should also be right up front with you that I don't have a background in groundwater. My undergraduate degree is in music. That'll do you well at a party, but it doesn't get you too far talking to a room full of groundwater scientists. But that said, my father was a geophysics professor at the University of Waterloo, and so when I was a kid, I was hanging out with hydrologists such as John Cherry and grad students in this sort of field. So I like to think I absorbed some knowledge through that way, but that's about the extent of it. So what I would like to speak to you about today is a kind of hot topic in water law that pertains to groundwater, and I thought might be of interest to you, sort of an emerging legal issue here. And it's an issue that's come up in my practice for several clients recently, and it's also an issue that I think is very likely to be addressed by the United States Supreme Court this coming year. And that issue is this. Does the Clean Water Act, the Federal Clean Water Act, govern discharges into groundwater that is hydrologically connected to jurisdictional surface waters of the United States? And if the answer to this question is yes, that as a potential legal basis for Clean Water Act jurisdiction, this theory that's sometimes known as the conduit theory would expand the reach of the Federal Clean Water Act to cover not just jurisdictional surface waters, but also in certain circumstances, groundwater. So my talk today will provide a brief synopsis of the relevant legal framework, give a history of some of the cases on this issue that have come up through the mainly federal courts over the last 20 years, including what's really brought this to a head is this past year, here in 2018, there's been 5 decisions from federal circuit courts of appeal, which is a really big deal when you're a water lawyer. And then finally look at a sort of some real world aspects of this, an example of a case I worked on, as well as some of the key technical questions that come out of this legal issue. So this question really involves an interplay between a broad scope of federal authority or state authority over waters versus a more narrow scope of federal authority over waters. State law, the states generally have broad authority to regulate all aspects of water within their jurisdiction. So, for example, here in Minnesota, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is authorized under Chapter 115 to administer and enforce all laws relating to the pollution of any of the waters of the state. And this key term, waters of the state, is very broad. It includes, you know, wetlands, streams, lakes, ponds, and then generally all bodies or accumulations of water, surface or underground, natural or artificial, public, private, which are contained within, flow through, or border upon the state. And then state law, in turn, prohibits discharging pollutants into any of these broadly defined waters of the state until you have a permit that's granted by the Pollution Control Agency. By contrast, the federal law is much narrower. The main federal law controlling discharge of pollutants into waters is the Federal Clean Water Act, and the act requires an NPDES permit, a National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit, to discharge any pollutants into navigable waters from a point source. So whereas under state law, states can control any discharge into any water, under federal law, you're dealing with only point source discharges into only navigable waters. Those two key terms, a point source is defined as a discernible, confined, and discrete conveyance, and then navigable waters is unhelpfully defined as waters of the United States. If you know anything about this topic, you'll know that waters of the United States has been litigated from here to who knows where, and is a whole other presentation. But a couple of things you can say about it, it excludes a good number of surface waters, like, for example, isolated wetlands that aren't deemed to be within the scope of federal jurisdiction, and as well as groundwater relevant for our purposes here. Most people agree that the Clean Water Act, navigable waters, does not include groundwaters for kind of obvious reasons, I guess. So as a result, if you're discharging pollutants into groundwater, you'll be subject to other types of regulations, but you won't require an NPDES permit under the Federal Clean Water Act. However, and this brings us to the case law part of our discussion, about half the courts in the country that have considered this issue that I was mentioning early have decided that under this so-called conduit theory, if a discharge of pollutants to groundwater subsequently migrates through that groundwater and ends up in a jurisdictional surface water, that this constitutes a de facto discharge to the surface water. So in effect, the groundwater acts like a conduit, much like a pipe or something like that, that's delivering the pollutants to the surface waters. That's hence the name, the conduit theory. Courts taking this broad view say that, you know, the whole purpose of the Federal Clean Water Act is to protect the quality of the nation's waters. So to allow this kind of loophole, if you will, to get out of NPDES permitting would defeat the purpose of the act. And here's a quote, for example, for one of the courts that hold in this way. They say, Congress intended the Clean Water Act to protect the water quality of the nation's surface water. So where the facts show a direct hydrologic connection between groundwater and surface water, that goal would be defeated if the Clean Water Act's jurisdiction did not extend to discharges to groundwater. On the other hand, you have courts that take a more narrow view. They say that, you know, by nature, federal jurisdiction for all things is a carve-out from the state's broad jurisdiction. So whereas the states have broad authority over water, federal is designed to be limited. If Congress had intended the Clean Water Act to apply to groundwater, to discharges to groundwater, they could easily have expressly included that in the act. And the fact that they didn't meant that they must have thought state groundwater regulatory programs and other programs would be sufficient to control discharges to groundwater, including any subsequent impacts to surface waters. So here's a quote from the other side. They say Congress did not intend for the Clean Water Act to extend federal regulatory authority over groundwater, regardless of whether that groundwater is eventually or somehow hydrologically connected to navigable surface waters. Can't you just hear the contempt dripping off of those hydrological connected? Courts favoring this narrow view also have questioned whether groundwater seepage can really be a point source. I mean, you think of a point source being like a pipe, typically. Can groundwater seepage that percolates down through, can that really be a point source within the meaning of this Federal Clean Water Act? So this brings us to, as I said, this year there's been a remarkable 5 cases from federal circuit courts of appeal. And I'd just like to go through them really briefly to give you an idea of what the federal courts are talking about here. The first one was a January decision from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and this involved a municipal wastewater treatment facility in West Maui, Hawaii. And this is a picture of it right here. The facility disposed of treated sewage into a series of 4 injection wells that went down into the groundwater. That groundwater, they were located about a half mile from the Pacific Ocean, and the pollutants, tracer dye studies showed that the pollutants were carried via the groundwater out to the ocean. In fact, I think something like 60% of the sewage ended up going directly into the groundwater, so it wasn't too complicated of a situation. So the Ninth Circuit said, well, in this situation, the discharge was illegal under the Clean Water Act without an NPDES permit. They said these injection wells were clearly point sources. They were, you know, discrete, confined conveyances, and the ocean was obviously a waters of the United States. The fact that the pollutants did not go directly into the waters of the United States didn't trouble the court. They said that the Clean Water Act only requires that the pollutants must be fairly traceable from the point source to a navigable water such that the discharge is the functional equivalent of a discharge into the navigable water. So they held that an NPDES permit was required in that situation. The second, third, and fourth of these 5 cases all involved decisions involving coal ash lagoons. So we have 2 decisions from the Sixth Circuit and 1 from the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. So here, this is not a picture of one of the facilities, but what these facilities generally look like. So this is, power plants that burn coal and then generate this ash, and they store it in part in ponds like this. So in this situation, the some of this water containing pollutants such as selenium and arsenic went into groundwater and then was transported via the groundwater into nearby surface waters. And the question was, does that require an NPDES permit? The Sixth Circuit held that the discharges to be within the purview of the Clean Water Act, they have to come directly from the point source. Here they said the pollutants from these lagoons reach the surface waters only indirectly via groundwater. The court also said that they didn't think groundwater was a point source. It's too diffuse, better characterized as a non-point source. So as a result, they held that no point source, no MPDS permit was required. And here's a quote from that decision saying, you know, for point sources to discharge into navigable water, it must dump directly into those navigable waters. When they're going to the lake from groundwater, it's they're coming from groundwater, which is a non-point source conveyance, and the Clean Water Act has no say over that conduct. So they said no MPDS permit is required in that situation. The Fourth Circuit dealt with basically identical facts, a coal ash lagoon with seepage that made its way to the nearby surface waters, but they took kind of a different, they did not focus on whether it was indirect or directly discharged into the waters. They focus on whether there was a, whether the source of the pollutants was a point source. So this case, they looked at the coal ash lagoons and they said, well, that's not really a point source. So and here's a quote from them saying, you know, these settling ponds could not be characterized as discrete points, nor did they function as conveyances. Rather, they're just like the rest of the soil at the site, static recipients of the precipitation and groundwater that flowed through them. So they decided that the lower court was wrong in saying that they were point sources as defined under the Clean Water Act. And so again, no MPDS permit was required. Finally, the last of these five decisions also came from the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, but it involves slightly different facts, and as a result, the court came out a little differently on this. This involved a gasoline leaking from a ruptured underground pipeline. It went into they seeped into groundwater and made their way to surface waters, and again, the question was whether that violated the Clean Water Act without an MPDS permit. The court differentiated between the coal ash decision. They said, here, you've got this pipe. This is clearly a traditional point source. Where, as opposed to the coal ash lagoons, this is a point source. So because the discharge of pollutants starts with a point source, we don't care how it ended up getting to the jurisdictional surface water. Because it started with a point source, we think this is within the purview of the act. So they said that here the plaintiffs have alleged that the pipeline is the starting point and causes the pollution, and that the plain language of the Clean Water Act requires only that a discharge come from a point source. It does not require that it go directly to the navigable waters. So there again, an MPDS permit was required. I should point out that these cases have all, petitions have been submitted to the United States Supreme Court. As you probably know, the Supreme Court does not have to review these appeals. It sort of has discretion. So it'll, I think, decide on these. I believe they're scheduled for the end of this month to decide whether they're going to take up this case. Typically, when you have federal courts of appeals disagreeing on a subject, it means that it's pretty likely the Supreme Court will take it up. So, and if they do, then I think you'd probably expect a decision sometime in the first half of next year. So I should also point out that the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is where Minnesota is, they haven't decided on this issue yet. And to my knowledge, no Minnesota court has as well. But if the Supreme Court did, that would then be binding in Minnesota. So that's the case law. So moving on here to a couple sort of, you know, how does this shake out in the real world here? You know, we've been talking in mostly theoretical terms, but you might well ask, well, what does this matter? In my practice, deal with a lot of people that are, you know, looking at doing some sort of a discharge, whether it's an industrial facility or municipality. And it makes a significant difference whether you can proceed, whether you have to get a MPDS permit or whether you don't can proceed, say, under a state SDS permit only, for example. And just for example, some of the ramifications of having to get an MPDS permit, because it's a federal program, EPA ultimately retains authority to review, approve, and ultimately, if they want to, veto the permit and issue a separate permit themselves. And if you're a discharger, typically if you can avoid having EPA all up in your business, you want to do that. Secondly, partly because of this federal overlay, there's some additional processes and opportunities for public comment and legal challenges, which especially if you have, say, a controversial project, you would like to avoid those situations if you can. And third, and this is the one where I've seen perhaps more of the issues and perhaps some confusion arise, is that the federal Clean Water Act has certain types of restrictions that you don't have under state law. Like, for example, the the one that jumps out to me is that EPA has established a whole series of industry-specific technology-based effluent limitations. So if you fall in a certain type of industry category, you have to meet these standards. Basically, you have to come up with the technology that can meet these standards, typically at end of pipe. And so those things apply if you're in the MPDS world. If you're not, there's other state types of restrictions, but typically not as stringent as those. So to give you an example, this is from a loosely based on a case I worked with, not here in Minnesota, just so you know. But so here's my diagram of the situation. So you've got an industrial facility that generates wastewater. It's run through a series of treatments, pond based with like aerators, that sort of thing, and ultimately then piped to a pond some distance away, where it's allowed to just sit there, evaporate, and seep down into the soil below. In that soil, my consultants tell me that there's some significant biogeochemical processes that take place and remove a lot of the pollutants. In this case, it's BOD. But a certain amount then enters into the underlying groundwater, is transported, diluted to a certain extent, but eventually reaches this interface between the groundwater and a nearby river, which is a water of the United States for purposes of the Clean Water Act. For decades, the relevant state agency just regulated this as a groundwater discharge only. So you had monitoring wells and that sort of thing. But eventually, and partially on the basis of some of this case law, they said, well, we think this is actually a discharge that's subject to the Clean Water Act and ought to be covered by an NPDES permit. And this brought up some concerns with the technology-based effluent limitations. You know, it's one thing if you're meeting them at the end of a pipe that's going directly into the river, but how do you meet those when, you know, the point of discharge here, as I've sort of indicated at the bottom right, is technically where the pollutants are added to the river. And the point of discharge is where these technology-based effluent limitations are applied, unless doing so is infeasible. So the agency said, well, we think it's infeasible, so therefore you need to meet these T-bells at the end of that pipe that's going into the pond. This was problematic for this company because it deprived them of the benefit of that biogeochemical process that happened in the soil. And as a practical matter, if they were going to meet that standard at that point, they would have to install millions of dollars worth of mechanical treatment that would have put this facility out of business. So in situations like this, you know, where you've not been subject to MPDS permitting, you could face some very dramatic ramifications depending on how the case law goes in your state or from the Supreme Court. And then finally, just to touch on a couple technical aspects, and as I said, I'm not a technical guy, but these cases, you know, it's one thing to have the case law say, well, yes, these type of discharges are subject to the Clean Water Act. It's a whole nother thing then to say, go and prove it, or go and disprove it, as the case may be, depending on what you want to do. So even the courts that say, yes, the conduit theory applies and Clean Water Act jurisdiction ought to apply, they say, nonetheless, you still have to show a direct hydrological connection. Exactly what this means is, you know, I think up for grabs. You see there's cases on this. You tend to see the cases discussing the legal things and only little bits and pieces of this, but, you know, things that have come up of, you know, the geologic features, the flow rate and direction, you know, how long a connection it is, how long it takes for the groundwater to get there, probably things that you all know a lot more about than I can ever imagine. But those sort of issues, it moves from being a legal question to being a highly technical question. The other thing that's come up is that the courts have said, well, you have to show that more than a de minimis amount of pollutants actually reaches the jurisdictional surface water. So again, you know, like in that situation I was saying, I think the regulatory agency sort of said, well, there's a hydrologic connection, you're discharging, therefore this is a Clean Water Act type jurisdiction. Well, if you could show, no, actually no pollutants ever make it there because, say, for example, the groundwater flows a different direction or something like that, then, you know, you could contest that holding. And then finally, I think that my limited experience working on these cases has shown that some sort of, especially since the case law and the application of these sort of surface water conceived standards to a groundwater world is kind of tricky. I think some sort of outside the box solutions are likely to be needed. And just a, you know, quick example here, whereas in this case where the agency was saying, well, you've got to meet those standards at the end of pipe because we think it's infeasible or not possible to actually know what kind of pollutants you're actually sending to the river. Or our consultants was like, well, you know, maybe there's a way we can actually figure that out by developing some sort of model or something like that. And, you know, there was some thought that the agency might not be comfortable with that. So consultants were saying, well, you might also be able to, say, sample the pond itself and then have an equation that can somehow back calculate in a way that the agency is comfortable with. And you know, what your actual effect on the river is. And, you know, in a situation like this, question whether it makes sense to impose, you know, a multi-million dollar treatment facility for an environmental outcome that's really not going to have much effect on the river in that way. So that's a quick summary of what's going on with the conduit theory and some case law. And I'd like to thank you very much for having me here today, and happy to take any questions if we have some time.